Okay. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll begin the get underway into the formalities of today. I'd like to welcome our guest speaker, Paul Grabowski. He has a massive biography. There's decades of things that you could talk about in all aspects of what he's achieved. So I'm just going to highlight a few things by way of introduction. Many of you will know him, of course, as an Australian pianist and composer. He has a national and international profile for work in film, TV, jazz, the arts, and, of course, as our artistic director of our Festival of Arts for 2010 and 2012. The Festival of Arts gig is bookended by an amazing amount of things. Many of us will remember him as the band leader of Groove-O-Matics, which was, of course, for 3 years on Australia's favourite TV show in the 1990s, Tonight Live with Steve Izard. You know, after that came the Australian Art Orchestra. There were tours with the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, tours in Europe with James Morrison, working in India and Bali, which resulted in some significant works, Olympic Games, opening and closing ceremonies, opera, film scores, albums, ARIA awards. One thing, though, that struck me when I was doing my research was I forgot that he also worked for the ABC and was commissioning editor for arts and entertainment there. And his legacy was that great documentary of covered the history of Australian popular music, A Long Way to the Top, which I'm sure many of you watched, bought the CDs, and maybe even gone to the concerts. I was really fascinated what Paul said about his time at the ABC. Nothing could have prepared me for that, for the political minefield that came buried in this sodden turf. The ABC, a political football kept in play since the 70s, underwent one of its regular budget cuts early in my time as an executive, and the organisation went through a kind of mild systemic meltdown with a rationalist agenda forcing a split between the commissioning and production areas in television. This without really taking into account the fact that a lot of the expertise necessary to make good arts programs from both a journalistic and production perspective were found within and nurtured by the old departmental system. The powers that be finally figured that out and returned to the old structure shortly after my departure. Add to that some ill-advised tampering with programs and personnel, and the whole thing was tedious. His insights could well be interesting given what's happening at the ABC now with regards to further budget cuts, particularly in an area I'm sure he's interested in, the arts, but also one that we're also interested in South Australia, in the sports areas. As I said, Paul's biography is too extensive to go further on, but some things to note. Born in Papua New Guinea, raised in Glen Waverley in Melbourne, which I guess makes you a Hawthorne supporter. Oh, no. There you go. So I was going to say good luck for Friday night, not. He dates his music interests to the early age. Oh, yeah, I can say good luck, can I? Oh, so it's the other team, is it? Right. He dates his music interests to the early age of 2, starting piano lessons at 5. Studying from the age of 7 with the Melbourne University Conservatorium's senior lecturer, Mark Drost, who he describes as a second father, who taught him the secret of good piano playing is the creation of a beautiful sound, which Paul says can often be overlooked in jazz music. His love affair with jazz started at 16. He says that not being a sportsman, he wanted a school activity that might attract the opposite sex, and Wesley College had a jazz ensemble. Maybe he'll tell us how that went. I like this quote. He says, "It didn't take long before I realised that jazz was the music that I was destined to play. I think it was the marriage of rhythm and line that swept me away." Paul Grabowski.
Well, beware of introductions by journalists, particularly editors. Good Lord, very well researched. I'd like to acknowledge that we are here on the land of the Kaurna people, and I respect their relationship to their land. Well, ladies and gentlemen, as a practicing artist on the one hand and as a festival director on the other, I can't have many excuses not to have cause to reflect on the realities of being an artist in Australia and comparing the local situation with the lives of artists elsewhere. The federal government has recently released a national cultural policy document, as a basis for submissions towards the first major policy initiative in the area since Keating's 1994 Creative Nation. The terms of its discussion look at the place of culture generally within the contemporary Australian experience and speaks broadly, if somewhat vaguely, it is a discussion paper after all, of the general importance of cultural industries to our ability to be a creative, dynamic society moving forward. Usefully, it does speak to the importance of arts as a central part of the national curriculum, and very importantly, of the centrality of art to Indigenous health and well-being, and the importance of the conservation of Indigenous languages towards that end. Now, practicing artists are really the pointy end of this discussion. While it is no doubt true that the centrality of a useful experience of or understanding of art is essential to the ability of a contemporary society to flourish, a career as a practicing artist is ultimately chosen by relatively few. The drop-off rate can be high. You could say it's a young person's game, with the early lean years being an acceptable lifestyle choice before the sobering realities of middle age kick in. Most artists remain on the lowest end of the economic scale, while investing in real terms much more of their time contributing towards their own productivity through constant engagement with their practice. You could say artists have high job satisfaction, that they are self-employed, and that therefore in principle no different from any other sole operator, and that art is, after all, a high-risk occupation dependent on the vicissitudes of the marketplace. And yet we seem to regard the artist differently from labourers, cleaners, or others who might be on similar pay scales. Why? Why is it that not all artists choose to paint, write, compose, or perform in ways far more likely to earn them the big bucks? Why are so many compelled to explore unknown landscapes, expressing our human journey in new and unexpected ways, challenging audiences, asking difficult questions, working actively against what would seem to be the natural impulse to seek food and shelter? Surely it cannot be said, that art, particularly if with that word come all the various moral and ethical positives with which we surround it, that it is a product of market forces, the art market notwithstanding. The values we apply, the canonical nature of our evaluation, is often accorded posthumously. Bach was a working musician and a writer of many a barbed missive to employers seeking better pay and conditions. Van Gogh couldn't sell a painting. Could it be because the artist is called that the roots of the profession are buried deep in a place where what is now an artist was once a magician, a shaman, a healer, and storyteller, and that the role of the artist is to provide various narratives, prophecies, and inner mappings of our experience? Whether or not this is true or even partially true, there is no doubt in my own case that I have never seriously planned to work in any other field, but that the harsh realities of being an artist in my homeland have caused me to have to make some tough decisions, and that therefore any discussion of a national cultural policy should not, in its widely conceptual social democratic framework, lose sight of the facts on the ground for the foot soldiers who give the arts their contemporary substance. As with everything else involving human life in our great red slash brown slash green land. The artistic life and career is subject to the peculiarities of its physical nature and resultant demography. It is little wonder that the first European expressions of an Antipodean otherness are to be found in the early drawings and watercolours of visual artists. Even when they attempt to render the strange landscape as a kind of untamed English park, there is a sense of the observer coming to grips with things hitherto unseen and with people difficult to comprehend. That these people, the first inhabitants, were and continue to be custodians of the oldest artistic traditions on the planet would have been news to these early colonists, motivated, I think, not by any sense of inquiry into the roots of human expression so much as to the burning desire to acquire grazing land or otherwise achieve material prosperity or improvement. The land continues to fascinate painters, and an unbroken lineage stretching from Glover, Gill and von Gerard through McCubbin and Roberts to Nolan, Williams and, say, Phil Hunter, continues to speak to an idea of the silent power and unpredictable volatility of our physical continent as an avatar. Literature came closely behind, with writers attempting to put this same series of impressions of a land on the other side of the world into words to convey something of its mystery and its potential to overwhelm. While living in Europe during the early 80s, I read a lot of Patrick White and was very taken with his ability to give voice to the land itself, to evoke its dryness, both solid and brittle, and its active presence in the fates of his characters. So, in word and image, both created, it must be said, in locations of their maker's choice, Australia has been well mapped. Music has lagged, if only because non-Indigenous musical languages, up to the challenge of similarly evoking this otherness, have only really been around for, at the most, 50 years. It could be indeed argued that our strongest musical statements of singular identity have been made outside of the classical paradigm by musicians in touch with the youthful energy that many Australians imagine as our best versions of ourselves. For the performing arts, which also unpack in so many ways the uniqueness of the Australian experience, it is the tyranny of distance that continues to be our greatest challenge. Most Australians, we may tire of hearing, live in our capital cities, and of those, close to half are in Sydney and Melbourne, and if we add southeast Queensland, then we have well over half. Given that we are talking about a country the size of the continental United States, with a population less than one-tenth the size, we are therefore facing a set of problems unique, just as our land is unique. Performing artists, as individuals or in companies, need to perform as often as possible. That might seem obvious to the point of glibness, but I am talking about economic reality as much as personal satisfaction. In parts of the developed world with higher population densities and commensurately higher levels of cultural activity, it is possible to enlarge and refresh a fan base through regular touring that takes in a far greater number of opportunities. In Australia, outside of our cities, regional centres simply can't offer anything like this level of activity. Our audiences are loyal and supportive. Our companies and individuals are innovative, indeed ingenious. But we are working within a finite environment. To deal with this, individuals work on multiple projects with various people, hopefully avoiding the curse of overexposure that can cause journalists to be reluctant in their, it must be said, ever-decreasing column space to report on a particular project because we did him last month. Festival directors face similar problems of having to make choices out of relatively small, if rich, fields of local possibilities. With regard to Australian work, the most useful function of the highly subsidised multi-art form festival is in its advocacy of local content, particularly through the commissioning and presentation of new work of a kind not achievable via other means. Then there is the possibility of contextualising Australian work within a high-end festival lineup, an international lineup. As large festivals are tied into an international network of similar events, surely the possibility of international co-commissioning raises the likelihood of new Australian works of scale reaching high-profile international podia. It may be of interest that in next year's Adelaide Festival, across all art forms, 62% of content is Australian, with a considerable number of new productions in which the festival has a real investment. This relates to the primary problem, linking the Australian performing arts in a practical way to an international touring circuit. With the emergence of a Chinese middle class and the increasing liberalisation of public expression in various parts of Southeast Asia, we find ourselves entering into an era of what could and should be increasing cultural exchange with our immediate neighbourhood. There is mention in the Minister's discussion paper of the importance of cultural diplomacy. But if this is to be achieved, there would need to be greater expertise and resourcing in DFAT to allow such a thing to occur meaningfully. For every art form, there's a different network. Cultivating these takes time. And it is totally dependent on information sharing between the artist's own initiative as entrepreneur and the ability of the cultural attaché to make equivalent contacts on the ground. Now, on this matter, the internet does allow artists, particularly in cross-platform and digital media, as well as music, to reach international audiences. If we take a niche form dear to my heart, like jazz or jazz-related music, or post-jazz, as I like to think of what I do, if we take that as an example and accept that it makes up anywhere between, say, 3 and 5% of music sales, then that could translate globally into a golden opportunity for a recording artist. It really is then up to the market to decide what will break through. This is the artist as small business person before the onset of posthumous canonisation. However, a concerted strategy toward helping performers to reach their audiences by various means, including online and tour support, is still very important. It is the telling of our stories by our people to our people, and the interest the rest of the world might have to hear them, that is at the root of this. The more we can imagine our place and its relation to other places, the greater the chance that we can realise it. We are told in the discussion paper that cinema attendance is a cultural activity. And to be sure, it is. But are we attending Australian films? Not nearly enough. We attend symphony orchestra concerts, but are we hearing Australian music? Hardly at all. Australian operas? Thin on the ground. We do need to be sure that in addressing the need for a cultural policy, the promotion of our own creative collateral is at the centre. Not in an autarkic sense, far be it from me to navel gaze, But if a cultural policy is to have results, then surely it is in the collective pride we should take, in the freedom we have to dream, and to apply the dreaming to real outcomes. Thank you.
So if anyone would like to ask questions of Paul, we'll certainly take those.
Hello, I'm Alex from The Advertiser. I just wanted to ask you, you touched very briefly on this at the beginning about curriculum in schools. I understand in South Australia, I'm not sure if it's 100% correct, that English in Year 11 and 12, or perhaps just in Year 12, is no longer compulsory. And I was just wondering whether you feel that, you know, these kind of decisions made by education departments are affecting people's decision to pursue careers in the arts?
Well, I'm not aware of that fact, so I can't speak to its veracity or not. But if it were true, and I have to accept what you say on face value, then my own personal opinion would be that that's a very strange decision. And that surely one of the things which binds us together as a community is our ability to at least be able to understand each other, and that therefore, like it or not, it is important to have a language which we collectively decide is the one that we're going to speak. This is not Switzerland. So I would be opposed to any removal of English in any way from the higher levels of education. A, because I think there's much to be gained by reading books, and I'd hate to see that disappear either, but also for basic reasons of social cohesion.
Des Ryan from InDaily. Paul,
Des,
you concluded your piece by suggesting that the more opportunity we have to imagine our place, where we live and what we are, obviously the better it is for us as a culture. But your very next words were that we don't attend the cultural offerings that are presented to us, and it rather begs the question of maybe they're just not worth attending. There is something flawed about what we do offer as a culture that we either don't see, or maybe on a world, on a global basis, it doesn't match the standard or the expectation of this audience, this we, that's sitting here.
Okay, well, that's a big question, and a lot could be said to answer that. But I'll try and just give a couple of observations if I can. I was talking in the first instance about cinema attendance, and then I went on to talk about music and opera. In terms of cinema attendance, the first problem, of course, is that we are an English-speaking nation, but a relatively small one in terms of our population. But therefore, we are completely open to any other English language delivery system in terms of what we are going to choose to go and see at the cinema. If you compare our situation to non-English speaking countries, there's some interesting results. For example, a country like Korea has a very active cinema industry, and the great majority of films that Korean people go to see, not surprisingly perhaps, are Korean films. Similarly, in France, there's a far greater take-up of French films by French cinema goers. In Spain or in Tamil or in Hindi cinema, I'm sure it's the same. Our problem is overcoming the language barrier, and the language barrier in this case is English. Yes, okay, therefore it's about volume. We don't get to make nearly as many movies as we should be making in order to have a fair crack at taking the fight up to what is essentially a tidal wave of material which is coming from other places. What I think the point is that I'm trying to make is that we need greater productivity in these areas. We need to be making more things. We need to be giving more choices to people coming from ourselves. Because if we are to develop a more sophisticated, more consolidated approach as a nation towards being able to tell our stories to ourselves and also put them out to the world, then volume plays a fairly large amount in that, because not everything is going to be great. But the more stuff which is made, therefore the more likelihood is that some great works will emerge from that. With music, there's less of an excuse. Music is, a universal language. That the classical music scene still insists on a high percentage of music written between 1750 and 1910 is an indefensible position to hold. And no amount of trying to convince me that it is a priori better music will ever convince me of that, because it isn't. Really, the great works of the European canon, you know, are only really great when they're performed brilliantly. And we need to get used to the fact that in order to develop our own sense of our place in the cultural universe, there needs to be a lot more of our own exposure to what is being made here in order for us to be able to make a considered judgment in the first place. While symphony orchestras and opera companies are denying us the access to our own creative collateral, then we can't even make a choice.
Can you perhaps comment then, in the context of television, we have mandated local content quotas. Can you imagine a scenario where the Adelaide Festival will have a mandated local or Australian content quota?
I think we would happily live up to any attempt to do such a thing, because we are proud of our commitment to Australian work. I was thinking when I was writing this speech about the idea of, you know, should we have a quota system? You know, in order for an orchestra to achieve its funding level, should they have a quota system? Should we be actively engaging in trying to re-educate, if you like, our listening public about the merits of listening to Australian music? Well, of course, that's difficult. That's difficult. However, you know, these are highly subsidised organisations. They are in considerably more privileged situations than a lot of other independent or smaller organisations in the arts. And I do think they need to be held somewhat accountable for their steering of our culture, because a lot of it is in their hands.
Was that a yes or a no?
I'll leave that up to you, Des.
Mr. Grabowski, John Murch, Freelance Media, Radio Notes. The festival is, in the next couple of years, going to see one of the major sponsors stepping down one rung in its sponsorship. What views do you have that the corporate sponsorship, and I guess in many ways the major companies, can actually engage with the arts at a suitable level? And will you be using your influence whilst director to bring them on board?
Can I ask you which you're referring to?
Certainly. The Adelaide Bank, I believe, is stepping down in the next couple of years of the Adelaide Festival.
Well, actually, they've just...
A rung.
Well, I wouldn't quite put it like that. I mean, I would say that they have extended their support for the Adelaide Festival. I mean, don't forget, the Adelaide Festival situation has changed because it's gone from a biennial to an annual festival. So, in a sense, our ask is greater.
Sure.
So you could say that, you know, they've stayed at a parity, or possibly even, according to which way you want to cut the deck, increased their interest in the festival. So I'm not sure that's true. But I am happy to speak more broadly.
That'd be fantastic.
About corporate sponsorship of the arts, because it is a very important thing. Given the fact that, yes, government will always tell us that their resources are limited and that there's only so much they can afford to give to the arts, which, you know, has got something to do with the philosophical position they would already be taking vis-a-vis how important or not the arts are, you know, as opposed to the various other things that they need to spend money on. Therefore, you know, yes, the private sector needs to play more of a role. Now, the problem we have in this country, as opposed to, the United States, where government funding of the arts is, you know, really very, very little by proportion of GDP, for example. The private sector took a number of decisions in the late 19th century to invest in the moral uplift, if you like, of the society, partially through endowments dedicated towards the arts in various different ways. Now, there is a kind of a patrician idea behind all of this about, you know, what the arts really do represent. And we still do feed off that notion, I think, in most Western democracies, that art does play some kind of moral, ethical, you know, didactic role in making us better people. Now, I actually think that art is the natural expression of people, so I don't think it's something which is imposed from above. I think it's actually something which we all naturally do. Some of us obviously do it better than others because that's human nature. But I do think that, you know, given the fact that we have an economy in which some companies are making massive profits, that it would seem very odd to me that there isn't a structured governmental drive to make some of that money steer back into the arts in a very concrete kind of way, like either as percentages or as some kind of, you know, understanding that is reached. Because, wow, we could do well out of that with very little cost to them.
Rebecca Putty here from The Australian. You've previously supported the tower that's proposed to go behind Parliament House to have an art space on the ground floor. And there's been very, very strong support for the arts from the Premier previously. With the Premier standing down in October, are you concerned that support for the arts may dry up with under the Weatherill government?
Too early to say.
Is it a concern, though?
No, until there's something to be concerned about, I'm not concerned. I mean, I'll be very interested to see, after the Premier's departure, what the new cabinet looks like and who's responsible for what.
Tim Lloyd from The Advertiser. Paul, I was wondering, you couched that talk in terms of the national cultural policy, and I was thinking you've got various ways where you can make a contribution to that policy development. And I wondered whether you would think of doing that personally or through the Art Orchestra or through the Adelaide Festival. But I was also wondering if you were interested in making the 2012 Festival an argument in itself in some way, because you referred to the amount of Australian content you were putting in.
Well, thanks for the question, Tim. I'm not totally sure that I'd ever considered that the festival itself would be a kind of billboard for an ideological position. No, I think it's emerged very much out of the natural selections that we have made. As an Australian artist myself, I'm always going to be very sympathetic towards Australian content, and I wouldn't imagine that I was doing my job properly if I wasn't representing it to the best of my ability in the ways that I have described. In terms of my influence or lack thereof to have any kind of impact on the development of this policy, that's really, I guess, for others to determine. I mean, I am making this statement today in response to that document, and there's much more that I could say too, particularly with regard to Indigenous matters, although I do believe that that's best delivered by Indigenous people themselves, but I do have very strong views about the centrality of art to the Indigenous experience and to Indigenous health and well-being. I'd like to contribute. That's up to others to decide. Dear idea. Did you review them, or? Yes, why not? Why not? Music is for everybody, you know. That's the great thing about all of these things that I'm talking about. Art is not the domain of the artist. It's not owned by the artist. Art is something that we all share in. I'm a great believer in, and I've talked often about this, what I call the feedback loop between performers and their audiences. You know, you can't have one without the other. There is no meaning in being an artist unless there is an audience there to receive what you do. You might have created what you think is the world's greatest painting, but if it lies dusty in a garret for 300 years, then we'll never know until somebody dusts it down and says, my God, here it is, the Holy Grail, and we all go, wow. Now, it's at that moment, and that moment only, that that work of art starts to live. It is energised. It is given meaning by the responses to it. And I think the same thing could be said of any work of art. Art only exists in terms of the maker and the response to it. And until we start to understand that you can't have the one without the other, maybe we're only halfway towards understanding what art is. Elizabeth? Well, actually, I don't think you did anything wrong. And in fact, when I look at the output... Oh, right. Right. More to the point. Well, I'll try to answer it. I'd like to answer all of those questions, actually. But the 1973 model, I mean, when you look back, and, you know, my concert-going experience as a younger person were to... the various series that the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra used to have during the 1970s. And there was far more Australian music performed during that period than is now the case. I mean, I remember very often hearing music by Sculthorpe, Conyngham, Richard Meal. You know, there were many, many people, Felix Verda. You know, people were given an opportunity, composers in those days, to have their music performed. Now, look... there's a couple of ways of looking at this. One might be, dare I say it, perhaps the symphony orchestra is outliving its usefulness as the preferred mode of expression of contemporary composers. Maybe young composers are less interested in writing for 80 people, many of whom are disinclined to play their music, than for a highly motivated group of musicians of a far lesser number. Because it is true that there is a conservatism rampant in the orchestral system which makes it very difficult for composers of new music to find themselves being taken seriously. That's one problem. And the other is, you know, therefore one could say, possibly as a result of that, the defensive posture taken by that entire culture, trying to protect itself in a more competitive, less cosseted financial environment, in which they need to be seen to be balancing their books and forcing them into the grotesque kind of organisations which have to be backing bands for rock and roll stars trying to make themselves more acceptable in old age. You know, there's people who are doing, you know, orchestral versions of this, that or the other thing. Now, I don't think in my honest, you know, in my inner feelings that many of these finely trained musicians who've dedicated many years to becoming... you know, expert technicians on their instruments really saw themselves eking out their days doing that kind of thing. I would have thought that orchestral musicians want to play the canonical music that they have been trained to play, but equally that they would be interested in furthering the cause of music by giving of their talents to the latest creations by young people. Something is wrong, yes. There's a lack of metal. Is that right? Well, the ABC could be blamed for a lot, actually, in that regard, but let's not go there. Time's too short. But do they really consider texting to be an art form? I think they think texting is a way of communicating with each other, isn't it? I think we'll see art forms which are delivered by text, possibly, you know. I can imagine that's probably already happening. Poets who are using text as their mode of delivery, or even writers who might be using that kind of language as... And in fact, I think I've even seen that there's a novel written in kind of textese. Right. Perfect. Well, that'd be a tweet. You could tweet a haiku. You know. No, look, I think that art changes with technologies. Technologies always, you know, inform artistic practice and vice versa. And I don't see, you know, the text or the tweet as being in any way counterproductive to the further cause of art, because art is above and beyond all that. Art is something that we need to do. That we do it because we are human. It's part of our survival mechanism. It's part of what has brought us to this particular place in our evolution. I think it's something intrinsic to being human. So it will express itself in whatever media are available to it. Oh, you don't know. No. I've written one of those. Look, I've got a whole lot of things I want to do. I've been very fortunate in my life, Megan, as you alluded to in your introduction, that I have been able to see this area that I work in from various different points of view. And... But at the end of the day, I consider myself a pianist and composer. And it's as those two things that I would like to spend the next few years of my life, the next period of my life, rather than the next few years of my life. It sounds like the end. One of my great passions now is the work that I'm doing with Indigenous Australians, and you know, that's going to be very important to me, and the future of my ensemble, the Art Orchestra, the Australian Art Orchestra, again, equally important. And just, I think, being able to contribute in whatever ways I can to being a useful artist, because artists can be incredibly useful people. I think we have a lot to be able to share with people in all kinds of ways, to give them opportunities to make them think about things differently, to increase the quality of their lives. And Australia is a country, thankfully, which allows us at least to do that. So that's what I hope and intend to do.
On behalf of us, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Add to the cellar, and I think all of us will be looking forward to. Well, I know I am. The program is out soon, Kate says. It's at the print, gone to the printers for the next festival, so I'm sure we'll all be seeing copies of that well before Christmas, anyway. Because of course it's an Adelaide tradition to give each other tickets to festival shows on the Christmas before a festival of art, so that's definitely on the shopping list for Christmas. So we'll look forward, of course, for next year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan.
And I'll be back. with a raffle draw shortly.